Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Rylan. On the show today, we're jumping in our time machine for an abundance of period dramas that are out in the pictures this month. I'll be joined in the studio by the film critics Karen Krizanovich and Tim Roby to dissect them. Plus, we'll take the temperature of Canada's music industry and we'll get to grips with S-Town, the record-breaking podcast that's currently occupying everyone's time at the moment. All that and a little bit more too, all coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Now, before we get going with today's show, I'm hijacking this week's staff pick to tell you about something that I happened to enjoy last weekend. On Sunday, I popped down to the Above the Stag Theatre to catch a performance of Del Shaw's play, Southern Baptist Sissies, in which four gay boys come to terms with their sexuality in a Southern Baptist church. It's been widely well received, and I'm joined by one of the lead actors, Daniel Clemens. Daniel, welcome to the program. Now, start us off. Tell us a little bit about the play itself, because, look, it is quite obviously specifically an American play. The hint there is in the title, of course. But the themes that we're exploring here, they really do resonate everywhere, don't they?
Exactly. So the play is Southern Baptist Sissies. It was written in 2001 by Del Shaws. So just a little brief thing about it. It's about four gay men starting off as boys, growing up into adulthood in the Southern Baptist Church. So, I mean, it's quite a specific story it's telling about how these four boys deal with being gay in the church, in the Southern Baptist way, because it's quite, obviously, as you know, it's quite, I guess, anti-gay, anti...
It's a very, very conservative part
exactly,
of America.
That's the
and
one.
The Baptist church that these boys are a part of, it's a very, very conservative sector of the church as well. So we've got four boys here who all deal with it in different ways. Your character stands out amongst the rest of them, though. The rest of the boys seem to, at least privately, start to embrace their true selves gradually throughout the show. And without giving anything away, your character maybe gets to that point at some point during his character development, but there's a lot more resistance for your character, isn't there?
Exactly. So I play TJ Brooks in the play. Yeah, it's just a whole struggle throughout the whole play. The play is told through the main protagonist, Mark. So it's kind of like a short vignette scenes. It's not really like a long narrative, how you'd see in like a traditional play. So what that does is it kind of shows you different highlights of what this character Mark sees. And yeah, so my character, it's just really interesting. There are times where he like dips, he's about to, you know, be okay with it, but then he just keeps coming back. And I think because his father in the play is a strict military man, so there's all these forces all around him telling him what he is naturally is wrong, and he needs to go against that. And he uses the Bible as his way of justifying going against being gay.
And at the end of the production that I saw, the director of the play got up and gave a little bit of a speech, and he mentioned that it's funny how timely the production feels now, because, of course, it wasn't written in response to our political reality now, and yet it feels like it could have been written just yesterday. Do you feel that way as well? When you read this, did you have that sort of impression that it really does fit in with the global political reality for now?
Yeah, we are at an interesting time. So the play, as I said, was written in 2001, and the producer of the theatre where we're performing, it's called Above the Stag, and Peter Ball's the producer. He also runs the theatre, and he had this play for ages, and he didn't know when was a good time to use it, but now, as you said, like, it is the perfect time. I mean we all know we're kind of going back to the dark ages in a way, especially with minority groups. I mean, LGBT communities, but kind of everyone right now, all the minorities are going to be pushed aside if you're not a white straight man. Which is scary, especially in America.
Indeed.
So when you read the play, of course, it's sad, isn't it? Because what's that, 16 years that it was written? It's exactly, the themes are so true. And actually, I was in America at the end of last year, and I met a gay man there, and he was from New Orleans, so around the South, where the play is also based in Texas. And he was telling me that, like, he made, like, films about gay subject matter, and people would come up to him and be like, "Oh, I can't believe you're doing this. This is disgusting." And these are like family friends that were saying this to him. So it's massive, I think, still in the US, like, strife.
Absolutely. A stark reminder of how the world changes, but not everywhere so quickly. Daniel Clemens, thanks very much for joining us on the Arts Review.
Thank you.
Southern Baptist Sissies is on at the Above the Stag Theatre in London until the 22nd of April. Now, unless you've had your head buried in the sand over the past few weeks, you'll have heard much about S-Town, the new binge-worthy podcast from the people behind Serial and This American Life. Set in deep Alabama, it's billed as a true crime show, but it takes you down a much more intriguing tale of the people who inhabit the town of Woodstock, or Shit Town, as it's referred to by our main character, John B. McLemore. Holly Fisher sat down with Alice Vincent, arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph, to digest the first season. Warning, this may contain spoilers.
Alice, welcome to The Arts Review.
Thank you.
We've both binged on the new S-Town podcast. I don't, how many days did you do it in?
I think I started on Sunday lunchtime and I'd finished by maybe Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning. It was about 3 days.
Okay, I think I did it in two, so I might have
you beat me.
You.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, why don't you set up the premise of the podcast for us?
So S-Town is the new sort of baby sister from the team behind This American Life and Serial, which was a huge success in 2015, maybe 2014. And its premise is that a man named John B. McLemore, who lives in Alabama, sent an email to a radio producer saying, there is a murder that's gone on in my town and it's unsolved and the police are hushing it up. And at that point, they begin a long correspondence and eventually the radio producer goes down to try and unravel the crime. But what happens is actually a complete detour and far more fascinating.
That's the thing, I guess. It's kind of billed as this true crime murder investigation, but what we get is an investigation into A, person, and B, a town, and we find that out quite quickly. Was there a certain moment in those first couple of episodes that really hooked you and kept you going?
We are very much on spoiler territory, so I'm going to speak in platitudes, I suppose. But the moment when the plot shifts, I was cycling and I literally stopped my bike and gasped. It was just so astounding and such a cliffhanger. And the fact that it is based in reality makes it even more remarkable. And I was hooked from that point on, really.
I would say it's a much more poignant podcast than perhaps some of the things we've had from Serial. And it kind of looks at the human condition. And the way that the first podcast opens is the host, Brian Reed, talking about time and clocks, which seems like a bit confusing. And why is this man talking to me about clocks? Mm-hmm. But it makes sense as it goes on. And I found that to be one of the, actually, my favourite thread throughout the whole thing. How do you think they used the theme of time to really create an effective storyline?
We could talk about this all day. It's so meta. You could look at how we look at our binge media intake and how that relates to time and how all of us picking this up at different things. But I think what made me think when you brought that question up is I saw someone on Twitter say the opening of S-Town is the perfect opening to a novel. And I feel like actually it would work as a novel. It reminded me of other novels, and time has obviously been a proliferation and fascination for literary figures for centuries. I think that's what makes it more poignant. We're not staring down, you know, into police reports and murders and things like that. Instead, this is an examination of far more fundamental and far more human issues.
But then we've also got this town of Woodstock that is S-Town, Shit Town, that is Woodstock. How do you think that is portrayed in the podcast?
I think it's the one thing that is similar between Serial and S-Town is that everyone in it is treated, you never know which side you're on. There'll be a whole episode when you're like, oh my goodness, they're completely guilty. And then the next episode, you'll see a completely different aspect to them. And S-Town is treated just as another character. You start off and you only hear about how terrible it is, how it's full of rednecks and racists. And that changes as the series goes on and you start thinking, oh my goodness, this is quite remarkable.
And I think that's one of its strengths as well, is that, you know, the characters are portrayed in quite an unbiased way by Brian Reed, who's presenting, and you do get to see two sides of the story, but people have still talked about the ethics of how he's treated this town, whether, you know, he's sort of muddied its name a little bit, but and also the ethics of making a podcast about somebody who isn't alive anymore. What do you think about that?
It was something that I've wrestled with, and it's something that I've had discussions with. I mean, I'm a journalist, you are a journalist, we write about other people's lives subjectively all the time, but there were issues. He outed his homosexuality after he died, he made aspersions onto his mental health. These are things that we can't ignore and things we should discuss. And I also think that there are still people living in S-Town. They're still going about their business. Do they want to become a tourist destination at the very best or worst? And how is it going to affect their business? I think that one of the lawyers, John B. McLemore's lawyer, has come out and said, I've got to work here. I don't want to be known as the guy who works in Shit Town.
Where do you think the strengths of this podcast lie?
I think it lies in its depths of storytelling. The one thing that, you know, as a storyteller myself, in the broadest sense, I was amazed and really heartened by the amount of time that was put into it. They had these discussions for years. They started being in touch, I think it was maybe 2015, it might have been before. There is so much joy from a journalistic point of view to put that much time into a project and have it go well. But I also think, as you said, Brian Reed's unbiased presentation, his tracking down of all the people, is just good old-fashioned journalism.
Why do you think that the US have been so much better at doing this than the UK recently? Rather than just, you know, America's got a better podcast industry than the UK, but is it something about the American sensibility and American storytelling that makes it better?
I do think there's a bit of that. I mean, it's got to be said, people working on their own patch in local newspaper industry and local journalism in the UK are unlikely to get any of the really weird, very strange cases that we have seen reported in American local press for decades. Even going back to like Truman Capote in Cold Blood, it's kind of ingrained into that storytelling and that journalistic culture, which I just don't think it is here. You know, we've got the Penny Dreadful legacy. It all seems a bit, it just doesn't seem like a very British thing. And I don't think that we don't have the capabilities of it. And as you say, we don't have the podcasts for it. But our issues seem somehow more humdrum. I think it might even be a geographical thing. There's just fewer of us and there's less weird open space for these things to take place.
This is billed as a true crime podcast. Do you think it is a true crime podcast?
Well, there's not an awful lot of crime in it.
There's a few dodgy goings on.
There's a few dodgy goings on. And of course, it does wind up all with kind of like a looming court case. But I think actually what's more exciting is to look at it and say, is this an, just like Serial did before? Is this a whole new kind of podcast? Is this a sort of portrait of somebody? Is this a new way of storytelling that we haven't seen before?
Thanks to Alice Vincent, arts and entertainment writer at The Telegraph. S-Town is available to download now. And it's time right now for our film review. And I'm joined in the studio by Karen Krasanovich and Tim Robey. Welcome both to the show.
Hey.
Now, it's a big month for period drama, isn't it? Because we've got four films to discuss this week, the first of which is Their Finest. Now, in this, Gemma Arterton stars as a young copywriter during the Second World War who is offered a job to bring a female perspective to, well, propaganda shorts. Let's hear a clip.
You and me, given opportunities only because young men are gone. But to turn our back on those opportunities, wouldn't that be giving death dominion over life?
Girls like us, we serve all those people who gave their sons to one war and now their grandsons to another.
A clip there of Their Finest. Tim, just judging from some of the promotion for this film, it is coming across somewhat like a bit of a BBC made-for-television type affair. Is that inaccurate, unfair?
I think that is probably fair, to be honest. I would say the same thing was true of some of Lena Shurfig's earlier films as well, especially in Education. I thought that really was kind of like a BBC film, with sort of unusually good acting, I suppose, elevating it. And some of the actors here are really good. I actually think Sam Claflin is excellent. He's the male lead, and it's a sort of a role that could have gone for nothing. And actually, he's sort of better than he's ever been in it. Bill Nighy has a really plum role as well as the kind of incredibly grand director who thinks he's taking charge of this whole business, whereas in fact Gemma Arterton's character is the one coming up with the good script ideas. It's in the tradition of films about women during the war on the home front making kind of all the moves and actually having all the right ideas while the men are just kind of barrels of ego and pomposity, really.
It does feel as though we've had a couple of films in this sort of similar ilk coming out recently. I'm just thinking of Hidden Figures as another one that springs to mind. I suppose, as pure as the motive might be, you do run the risk of maybe becoming a little bit tokenistic when these films seem to come out so close to each other. It's not a bad thing that the film is trying to say what it's trying to say, but maybe it's not saying it as well as it could be said.
Yeah, I think that's actually fair enough. I mean, as a sort of feminist gesture, the film is absolutely fine, but would have been probably more helpful in the 80s. That's the thing. It feels as though we've gone way past this point already. And in fact, the characterization of Gemma Arterton's character feels pretty feeble to me. She's not at her best. I actually think she's been quite good lately. She was very good in The Girl with All the Gifts, the horror film, last year. She's been on an upward track, and I don't think this is the right part for her, really, to kind of show us what she can do as a leading lady. But that said, I thought Sam Claflin was unusually good, and there were other things about it that were very charming, and I know my parents would really like it if they watched it on Sunday night TV. They might not want to leave the house to go and see it. That's the only thing.
Yeah, there lies the problem. Karen, what are your thoughts on films from this sort of mould? Sometimes a film does come along, and just from watching a short trailer, you know, a one-minute trailer, you can sort of come away thinking, I know exactly what this film is going to tell me. Is that okay?
Well, generally, I think you can tell by the poster a little bit, because the trailers can be very misleading.
That's true. Trailers quite often, trailers are better than the film.
Yeah, exactly. Or they tell you too much, or they steer you in a different direction. I think the poster tells you a great deal about what kind of tone you can expect and what the marketing is going to be on a film. So it gets you to the point where this is what they want to sell you rather than probably what it is. And I think it's probably better than the 80s. It's probably a great tagline for the poster. So you're genius, Tim. I think that, you know, even as a woman, I'll speak collectively for women. You know, it's great to see women being smart in a male setting. It's wonderful. I mean, we all love 9 to 5, right?
Exactly.
But there is a definite drag or a delay on this, where you have to start telling that story in a new way. And I was thinking you can also have, like, the underdog or the young guy, the old guy or the thing or the immigrant or the whatever. I mean, that role that women are playing could be played by virtually anybody except maybe the wealthy, smart, white guy. You know, maybe. So I think that this is just another underdog movie that is put in a period setting that people might enjoy.
It's a little bit patronizing towards her as well, because she's still presented as rather uptight. And she sort of has various barriers that she has to drop before she can admit that she really quite likes Sam Claflin's character.
The notorious uptight career woman.
That's a bit of a problem again. Yeah. And it's like it's sort of presenting that in the 40s, and it's not really better than doing that now.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that, I mean, we had a film about a career woman in the 40s, Mildred Pierce, but that was made in the 40s. So, you know, you can sort of get away with it back then, can't you? Okay, well, we should move on because we have some other film to discuss in what is becoming a relatively short amount of time. Their Finest is out in cinemas right now. Let's move on to another British drama, though, Tommy's Honour. This one tells the true tale of a talented young golf caddy named Tom Morris and his battle with the class system in Scotland to become a golfing champion. Do I sniff another underdog story? Perhaps. Let's hear a clip.
That young lad of yours, he'll make a fine caddy one day.
Thank you, sir.
Why did you let him talk to you like that, Dad?
Because he has every right to. I work for him and the other gentleman.
Your station in life was set before you were born.
A caddy, son, you are. And a caddy you'll be.
We'll see.
What else would you be doing?
Well, I'll be a golfer.
A clip there of Tommy's Honour. On the face of it, Karen, we have a sporting film here about an underdog. It's a British film. It doesn't feel like that long ago since we had Eddie the Eagle. Is it time for another British underdog story in the sporting world?
Wow, that's a heck of an analogy there. Tommy's Honour is, it may look like it's about golf. It's actually about a son and his father and how they come to blows and sort this out. It's a real, I don't want to say it's a labor of love, because it's better than that. This film is criminally underexposed in this country. It's opening globally on the 14th. But Tommy's Honor is Jason Connery's fifth feature, and he's Sean Connery's son. He's been an actor in almost 80 films. He's really, when he got involved with this, he really put his heart and soul in it, made a Scottish movie, which is beautifully done on a very slim budget with a terrific cast. Peter Mullen, Jack Loudon, and Ophelia Lovibond. And this film is a lot more than Eddie the Eagle. It's a lot more than Tweed and Sticks and Grass and Sam Neill playing a English guy, you know? It's this movie has so much texture and so much heart. And it's not lovingly crafted. It's incredibly well-crafted by Jason Connery. And I think it's time for him to get his reckoning as a director. I think it's time for people to see this movie and really look at his career and give him the due that he's deserves.
Well, you were speaking earlier about film posters and how you can tell a lot about a film from its poster. On the face of it, if I were to look at this on paper, I would see British film about golf. No, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Help me see past that. What else are we talking about here?
There's a lot of nuance here. I mean, although it's based on a book from 2007, Time is Out of the Story of Old Tom Morris and Young Tom Morris, which is about how golf started in Scotland. And it's very easy to say, oh, I bet that this is why Jason Connery made this movie, because of father. You know, that it's a father-son kind of, you know, headbutt, two rams running at each other. It's about personalities. It's about clash. It is about class somewhat, but it's more about something emerging from a small country. It's more about, if anything's an underdog here, it's Scotland. And it's got beautiful characterizations. And the, you know, golf is kind of secondary. I mean, I don't have a handicap. Last time I was in a sand trap, took me 14 strokes to get out. And when I got out there, everybody was laughing. So there, it's not about golf. It's really about a man and his father, or a man and his son. And anybody who's a son or a father, I think, should see this, because that's really the gist of it.
Tim, it's not about golf.
Not particularly.
Do films like this, memorable films that take place in the sporting world, are they usually about something a little bit more deeper than the sport itself?
I would say, yeah. I mean, the good ones tend to be. I really liked Friday Night Lights that they spun off into the TV series,
Peter
but
Burke.
I thought the film was very good because it was about the kind of depressed community that game was going on in, and these kind of blighted lives. The worrying thing about this film to me, just based on the poster, is that it looks like the sort of film that Donald Trump might endorse.
Because that's incredibly unfair
goal.
And really, really wrong.
Is that libelous? I don't know.
I think the poster, if I can interject, I think the poster, you're looking at, and I'm sure there's several of them, it's when you've got a film that's working on a certain kind of budget, you're going to end up with a certain kind of poster.
Sure.
And that's another thing to consider. But Trump, I don't think so.
We should be clear. Donald Trump has not yet endorsed Tommy's honour, so it is still safe to go and see the film, which conveniently is out in cinemas today. Now we turn to Lady Macbeth, William Oldroyd's film not about the Shakespearean character, but an adaptation of Russian writer Nikolai Leskov's 1865 novella Lady Macbeth of the Metensk. Tim, this was quite the star of the film festival circuit a little while ago. Was it deserving of all the praise?
I really think it was, yeah. I think it's terrific. It's a first feature by William Oldroyd, who's best known for theatre before this. It's a breakthrough part in the lead role for Florence Pugh, who had a supporting role in Carol Morley's film The Falling, the one about the hysterical schoolgirls. There she was pretty fantastic, but here it takes it to a whole new level. I mean, she's completely in charge of this film. She's this young newlywed who decides very quickly into her marriage that it's stale and stagnant, and that she's going to really liven things up by basically taking a shine to the stable boy. It's very much a Lady Chatterley scenario. But then beyond that, and where the Lady Macbethness of her really comes in, is that she becomes increasingly kind of murderous in her plan to essentially take over the whole household, and ropes in the stable boy into her schemes. It sounds wildly melodramatic, but it's shot with an incredibly cool kind of stately control, which I think is what makes it work. The kind of passions are kind of kept confined by the cinematography, which is absolutely beautiful. It's very painterly. It reminds you of Vermeer paintings quite a lot. And I think, yeah, it's just from a style point of view, a really fantastic debut and quite something.
Well, I'm quite a fan of melodrama, so I really don't mind if that's where it's hitting at all. Just before we go further on this, though, let's hear a clip.
Do you love me?
Of course.
Do you adore me?
Of course.
Through hell and high water, I will follow you. You're home.
You've acted so very shamelessly and so very stupidly. You will never see that man again.
We did it so that we could be together here.
You did it for us.
We did it.
We've heard lots about Florence Pugh, as Tim was just saying, Karen, taking a starring role in this. She has been very, very highly regarded. Are you anticipating greater things to come?
Oh, I think so, definitely. I mean, she's had like only two feature film roles, but she is very, very good. And the fact that she can carry this whole thing, it's really quite something. It seemed to me a little bit stagey, but then reading Oldroyd talking about how he used to take a camera and he would go and practice and he would like not move the camera thinking, it doesn't look quite right. I like the fact that it is painterly, it is a bit theatrical, it's very interestingly paced, but she really can keep that performance. And I think it was one location or something that they used or something like that.
Yeah, it's all shot in this actual castle, I think, that they found. Yeah. And I agree about the staginess in a way. It's a little bit like something like Miss Julie. You've only got a few characters and they're kind of circling each other in this setting, and it never really goes outside that. Mm-hmm. But it needs to be confined like that. It actually needs that quality to kind of maintain its tension. And it really spins off into ever more kind of crazy motives and situations.
It's unpredictable. Right? Yeah. I mean, what happens? You're just like, watch. You know, gosh,
some of the stuff she gets up to, you're like, whoa, I didn't think you would go that far.
Yeah. I'm like, go girl, oh, maybe not that far.
Exactly. That's what it's asking you all along, which I love. Mm. You're on her side, but then she starts doing more and more terrible things. Yeah. And you're like, am I now on your side? I don't think I can be
I
on your side
those
anymore.
Questions, though. I love
I mean, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but this is, I was hiding under my coat at one point.
One problem I often have with films like this, though, set in those sorts of settings, and I know we've discussed period dramas quite a bit on today's show, but sometimes it can be difficult to give you the actual feeling of being in that world. You can see something set in that world, but, you know, it takes a little bit more. It's very, very tricky to give you that feeling of being in some other sort of age.
Does I did see some succeed? Light sockets, actually, which ruined it for me. Anyway, go on.
No, that's pretty much my question. Did you actually get the feeling as though you were actually inside a period drama?
Because I work on set deck sometime, and I also help design films, and we're always looking for these telltale anachronisms, and I'm like, wait a minute, they got rollers on the bottom of the sofa there.
Oh, so Karen was at work then. That's
I'm,
not
no,
fair,
but
is
if
it?
If I'm seeing it, other people are seeing it too.
The thing is, I don't think it matters with this film. I think it's a bit like going to, in a way, a modern dress production of Macbeth or something like that, where the fact that you're in the medieval era, or in this case, in wherever we are in the 1865, it's neither here nor there. And in fact, the very contemporary style of Florence Pugh's acting is deliberately jarring from that anyway. So when she gets drunk in one scene, hilariously in front of her husband and her father-in-law, I think, she feels like a kind of contemporary woman getting drunk in the best way. It's incredibly funny. And the fact that she jars in that context is the whole point of the film to me.
Gosh, I thought that was naturalistic, but there you go. Mm. You know, we should swap roles sometime. You try being a woman and see what it's like. No, I didn't feel that it was particularly jarring because she was drunk. But that is the point. It does have a freshness to it. This film does seem contemporary, although set in a period. But I still can't forgive those light sockets.
Well, before Karen and Tim swap bodies, we should move on to our final film of the day. Lady Macbeth is out on the 28th of April. Now, we'll end today's film review program with The Handmaiden, which takes a Victorian erotic thriller called Fingersmith, written by Sarah Waters, and relocated to 1930s Korea, because of course. Now, Karen, walk us through the plot here.
Oh, don't. Come on now. What?
I know.
You wouldn't ask Tim this. they're ganging up on me. Stop them. It is one of those, you think this is happening, then that is happening. And I haven't read the book.
You can't really walk through this plot.
You have to run.
It's
like a hedge. It's a hedge maze is what this is. Okay. There is an heiress who has a lot of money, and she is played by Min-hee Kim. I'm always worried that I'm saying the names in wrong order. And the count, who is Ha Jung-woo, has decided that he is going to trick her, marry her, put her in an asylum in order to get her wealth, inheritance. So he enlists a young maid criminal. She's a talented pickpocket, played by Kim Tae-ree, and the name is Suki of the character. And this is actually Kim Tae-ree's film debut, and she's amazing in it. So they go, I think it's Japan, they go to Japan, and the maid and the lady sort of fall in love with each other. Mm. I suppose that's not a spoiler, is it?
No, not at all. No, that's really the...
Okay.
I think you've introduced it to the plot here. And then that's the initial stage, and then everything really starts to unravel in all sorts of different directions. But without giving too much away, Tim, this, I mean, the logline here is an erotic thriller, so we know that things get quite heated. Some criticisms have been that it's really just about sex and there's not a lot more to it. It's really it's a fetish film before it's anything else. What are your thoughts on that? Is that an unfair description?
I held out hope that this film was going to have some real emotional kind of impact at the end and real soul to it, and I felt that it didn't in the end, actually. I think it's rather a cruel film. It's kind of technically brilliant, as you'd expect from the director, Park Chan-wook.
Exactly, it has an amazing aesthetic to it.
It really does, and particularly things like costumes here are just extraordinary. The budget that's been lavished on these garbs is quite incredible. I think the further it gets away from the source novel, the more it turns into one of his slightly mechanical torture implement films where everyone's being put through the ringer and you start to sort of the relationship starts to get less and less credible towards the end. It sticks to the book for the first half, and I think that's definitely the strongest bit of the film. Mm. And I agree, Kim Tyree is fantastic. She's the young maid introduced into this household. It's a little bit like Hitchcock's Rebecca. She comes up the path and is introduced into this big gothic home. And for an hour or so, it's really spellbinding, I think. But then I feel as though Park Chan-wook steps in and meddles with the plot quite a lot and makes it more and more torture-y and makes the count into this kind of ridiculous villain cipher. Well, I've read some of the book and read the kind of outline of the final section, and I know that it's completely different. I think you can tell that he's kind of meddled with it. So in the end, it was a little bit disappointing for me. I think there's incredibly good surface pleasures all the way through it, but a slightly fetishy, cruel undertone. And the big sex scene, which is pretty saucy, is also kind of a bit dodge, I think. It's a little bit like male gaze-y.
Was it like blue is the warmest color?
It's a little bit
kind
of like how a man directs two women having sex. Mm. I was slightly bothered by it.
And also, I don't know if I can actually say this on the air, but hey, second film with scissoring. Who knew?
Yeah.
I became quite aware of the plot structure watching this film as well. And as Tim was saying, the sex scenes did feel somewhat mechanical rather than naturalistic. Perhaps that's my own impression. What were your thoughts on this, Karen?
Well, last time I had sex with a woman, did you on it from a different angle? I'm so sorry. Because we essentially see the same sex scene twice, once sort of, you know, out of camera and one full on, it was titillating. It was sort of, I don't want to say pornographic, it was erotic. I didn't get the sense that I didn't get any sense of realism. I got the sense that the camera was there and it was really more of an aesthetic display rather than something that is about the sensation or the experience. This is, as you said, the male gaze, really.
And it's scored, by the way, bizarrely to the music from The Thin Red Line. I don't think you want to be thinking about Japanese soldiers going over hills in the South Pacific while you're watching
it. I don't know. You might want to be.
That music is from The Thin Red Line. It's really odd that they chose that.
But I do think you're right. I think there is a chill to this film, although I did find it joyful in the essence of that the ending was good. I thought it was clever. I thought it was funny in many regards, but it is quite macabre and it is quite fetishy. But then again, I think that fetish is just becoming very normal now. Kink and fetish, nobody really blinks an eye. So it was exciting for me to see it. I thought it was a little long, but it was beautiful, and I thought the performances were tremendous.
Well, fetishes are becoming normal. Park Chan-wook and Paul Verhoeven are going to be out of a job
soon.
That's
exactly what I was thinking. If Verhoeven had got a hand on this, it would have been exactly the same.
We actually spoke to Park Chan-wook on the cinema show some weeks ago. Head to our website, monocle.com, for that. The Handmaiden is out in cinemas today. Thanks to Karen and Tim for your thoughts on the films for this week. Now time to head to Canada, where the music industry is enjoying a bit of a boom. International stars like Drake, The Weeknd, and pop heartthrob Shawn Mendes have all become ambassadors of sorts for both Canada's industry and the country itself. Canada's music offering has long been one of the most potent soft power assets, and recent moves by the government of Justin Trudeau have vowed to boost funding for the arts across the country. So what impact will it have on Canada's latest musical moment? Monocle's bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, has this report.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Sophie Gregoire Trudeau.
This year's Juno Awards in Ottawa, the biggest annual event in music here, was in part as much a memorial to the names of Canadian music's past as they were a celebration of the current crop of Canada's musical great and the good.
This past November, music fans around the world were saddened to learn of the death of Leonard Cohen, one of the greatest artists Canada has ever produced.
Regardless of all the evidence and the mountains of it, to the contrary, you know, we simply cannot help falling in love.
Leonard Cohen won 3 posthumous awards on the night, accolades his son, Adam Cohen, reflected on in the context of the current state of Canada's music exports.
Judging from the sheer decibels of the excitement around Shawn Mendes' name, I sensed maybe a collective disappointment that someone like my father was winning this award tonight, and somehow my son's little presence next to me assuaged my worry, and I felt a kind of complicity with him that was nice to have on stage.
Show me an open door, then you go and slam it on me, and I can't take any more.
Shawn Mendes, who won the People's Choice Award at this year's Junos, might be just the latest Canadian teenage heartthrob setting pop pulses racing internationally. But Canadian music, more generally, is undoubtedly in something of a purple patch at the moment. Drake, The Weeknd, Arcade Fire have all led the charge over the past few years. And their success has put a spring in the step of artists across other genres in Canada too. Here's the winner of this year's Country Music Juno, Jess Maskalouk.
What I love about country music is how diverse it really is. And I think that that's kind of what makes country country in a lot of ways. So I don't know. I love that we have Dallas on the rock side of the country, you know, and myself on the pop side and Gord on the traditional side. And I think that having it in one category like that really does represent Canadian country music really well.
The singer and songwriter Sarah McLachlan, who rose to fame in the 1990s and early 2000s, was inaugurated into the Canadian Hall of Fame at this year's Juno Awards and believes that Canadian musicians are still among the most potent soft power tools at the country's disposal.
I love the idea that I am a Canadian ambassador. I love this country. I'm so proud to be Canadian. I'm an artist, and I know that I have a voice that other people will listen to. And I feel the weight of that responsibility.
But we're all strange, and maybe we don't want to change.
The Canadian government is attempting to buoy the country's recent musical success with a boost to public spending on the arts, as Canada's Minister for Culture and Heritage, Melanie Joly, explains.
We're the third biggest exporter of music in the world. We're the third biggest producer of video games in the world. We're leading the way when it comes to audiovisual production. We're the third biggest center with Toronto after LA and New York.
Do you think there's quite a moment for Canada at the moment in terms of soft power and things like music and culture to really play in that? And what would you say that your goal or ambitions are to really emphasize the moment that we find ourselves in now?
I think that Canada right now is a beacon of hope. We've engaged in multilateralism again, the importance of diplomacy, and the fact that we invested $1.9 billion in the budget 2016 in arts and culture, and being the only G7 country reinvesting so much, talks about the importance we give to the arts and culture, but that we are playing as a progressive government to show other countries the importance of our sector, but also of progress and of supporting the arts for social cohesion reasons, but also for economic impacts also.
The fruits of this approach, which feel in stark contrast to the debate surrounding public funding for the arts and culture emanating from the Trump administration south of the border, are applauded by many artists themselves. Here's Peter Draymanis, lead singer of the band July Talk.
Spent a ton of time touring in the UK over the last year. They look at us stunned. Their jaws fall to the floor when we tell them that our country values arts funding, that there are opportunities that we can apply for that allow us to make videos, that allow us to make albums the way that we want to make them. And somehow the public really believes in that. And we're just so proud to be in a country that is the case.
Beauty is pain, and there's beauty in everything. What's a little bit of hunger? I
So, as another Juno Awards draws to a close, the mood here in Ottawa is justifiably upbeat about the health of Canada's music offering, both at home and around the world. As soft power symbols go, it's refreshing that musicians, audiences overseas, and the government here at home are, at the time being at least, singing from the same song sheet. For Monocle at the 2017 Juno Awards in Ottawa, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Monocle's bureau chief in Toronto there, Thomas Lewis, reporting from this year's Juno Awards in Ottawa on the state of Canada's music industry today. Speaking of music, to end the show now, I'm joined in the studio by Fernando Augusto Pacheco for this week's Global Countdown. Fernando, where are we heading this week?
We are heading to China, and what a pleasure, Ben, was to research the top five singles in China. Very good selection, I would say.
Yes, you were bounding into the studios just now with such excitement. Yeah. So start us off then.
Well, number five, I mean, it's a band called Lady Bees with GPS Mission. I mean, just when you see Lady Bees, what do you expect? I think it's exactly what you expect. It's a group of about, five young girls dancing a very up-tempo song. And they're all the time saying, like, GPS, GPS. And I think it's quite a great track. You know, it reminds me of a little bit of a K-pop, even though they're not from Korea. But it's a good start for the chart.
Okay, Lady Bees, GPS Mission, that's the name of the track?
Exactly.
Okay, and they presumably they say GPS a lot in this track.
Of course.
All right. Verdict aside, let's move on. What's next on the list?
Number four is a little bit of a calmer track. It's by Timmy Xu with The Heroes. And it's interesting because Timmy Xu is also an actor. That's what I spotted also in the Chinese charts. You know, I know it happens as well, like in the charts here. Like, for example, you know, like someone like Jennifer Lopez, she can also be on the singles chart or on the, you know, or do a film as well. But this happens quite a lot in China. So, you know, if you're kind of a successful actor, lots of them, they also release singles. They are as successful as their films, and Timmy Xu is one of them. It's a nice track. I would say almost a ballad. I would say not my favorite top five, but here you go.
Well, there was once upon a time when if you were a big star of the screen, it was expected that you could be a big star of the radio waves as well. And you know, maybe that expectation was lowered, but not so much in China then. All right. Well, we need to move on to the next part of the list. What's next?
Number three, you have another girl group, but this time it's called Ace Max with Red Hello School. So basically, think of Ace Max as kind of a more romantic version of Lady Bees. So, perhaps
Karen is laughing.
It is a bit, you know, more boring, and the video clip is very kind of sweet, romantic, almost like you're watching like an episode of Hello Kitty.
Okay.
Yes. Oh yeah. So it's not my favorite, but here you go. I'm sure they have their, their fan base there.
Well, we've always needed a more romantic version of Lady Bees, so I'm glad that we got there.
Do you want the best version of Lady Bees you can possibly have?
The which best is number all in one countdown? My goodness.
There's another girl group on number two, but this time they call ATF, and they were discovered because in China they have a competition called the XDE Project. So they selected this girl group among more than 30,000 contestants. And it's a fantastic song. It's called Win or Nothing. It's a very fast Europop beat. It reminds me of French pop from the early noughties. You know, do your research on French pop from the early noughties. And it's a fantastic video clip as well. I can definitely imagine myself dancing to this track in a Chinese disco. I mean, it's a shame it's not number one, but, you know, who knows, maybe next week.
Was it called Win or Nothing? I'm adding it to my phone right now.
Please do. Please do. It is a fantastic track.
Tim's been furiously downloading all the way through this list.
Wait for number one, Tim.
All right, so that is ATF Win or Nothing. And Fernando's tip, we need to go and research French pop from the early noughties.
Especially someone like Alizé, for example, as well. Big influence on ATF.
Fantastic. All right, so we're up to number one now, Fernando.
Very exciting track, Ben. Okay. And this one we have a clip to play. His name is Fang Jianyu, and he's also an actor as well. And we have a clip. This is the number one single of Special Beautiful Man.
So that special Beautiful Man, number one in China.
What did you guys think of it? Nice beat, no? It's quite easy in the ear. And
pretty bombastic. I mean, you could just play it really. If you everybody was drunk on the dance floor, it would get. It's a real floor filler, that one.
What I like about the Chinese charts, the songs in the first 5 seconds, you get, you know, that's what you get, you know, and that's, it's easy, you know, there's no like 1 minute introduction. It's just like, yeah, let's get down, you know. And I think it's quite a nice track. And I did some research on the actor and singer. It's interesting because he was part of a gay series in China called Counter Attack. And, you know, and he did quite a few of those kind of, you know, gay characters. You know, I don't know much about his personal life. It's very difficult. You know, there's not so much information about him, you know, in my research. But it's quite interesting that China is also quite open to gay themes as well. And even gay artists. Of course, there's been a crackdown. You know, there's a lot of series that had to be pulled out of national TV. But there's a lot of things online. And, you know, and it's interesting to see someone like Fang number one. And the track's called Special Beautiful Man. You know.
Bit of a clue there, maybe.
I think perhaps.
Or maybe he's talking about himself as well.
You never know.
You never know. Fernando, so that's number one single in China this week.
Very good one. Not as good as number two, but very good indeed.
Fernando, thank you very much for running us through the top music on the Chinese charts for this week. That indeed brings us to the end of today's program. Thanks to my guests, Tim Roby and Karen Krizanovich. The show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by our very own special beautiful man, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time next week, but for now, here's the rest of that very special track by Fen Jianyu. This is Special Beautiful Man. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.